The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Tom Gaynor, and he has a fascinating position in the world of investing and finance. He is the Chief Investment Officer and co-CEO of Markel Corporation, which he describes as a publicly traded family office. They have an insurance arm. That's the genesis and history of the company. But he also has been running the investment portfolio for quite a while. That's their second arm. And they have, for lack of a better word, a venture or private equity group that purchases companies. Really a fascinating history, a tremendous track record, and really a very interesting gentleman. I found this conversation to be fascinating, and I think you will also. So with no further ado, my discussion with Markel Corporation's Tom
Gaynor.
This
is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My extra special guest this week is Tom Gaynor. He is the CIO and co-CEO of Markel, a diversified financial holding company. He has been dubbed the next Warren Buffett by no less an expert than Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal. From 2000 to 2015, Gaynor's stocks have averaged a return of 11.3% annually, while the S&P 500 returned a mere 4.2% counting dividends. Tom Gaynor, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I've been looking forward to having this conversation. You're kind of an interesting guy working in kind of an interesting company. I don't think a lot of folks know what Markel is and does. Why don't we start by just give us the short version. What is Markel?
Sure. And in fact, not only do a lot of people not know what Markel does, a lot of people don't know how to pronounce it. So it's an easy screening technique. When somebody asks for Markel, they probably don't know who they're talking to. So yes, Markel, to some degree, I think the shorthand way of describing it in the usage of today's words is we're a family office that happens to be publicly traded.
Right.
Now, the way that business started was in the 1930s as a specialty insurance company. It's kind of an interesting history in that Sam Markel was in Norfolk, Virginia, and he was on the city council there. And Norfolk, Virginia was a place where a lot of veterans would be getting off the boat from World War I, some of whom decided to stay. And it was the early days of the automobile and trucking industry. So Sam Markel had been an insurance agent. There were veterans getting off the boat. They were providing cab rides, which were unregulated, unlicensed, nickel a ride. Jitneys was the name of the term. Of course, accidents ensued, as would be the case in anything like that. And Sam Markel got a law passed that said if you're going to operate one of these jitneys, you had to have insurance.
And we're just the people to provide it.
And, well, no insurance company was willing to take that sort of risk. So Sam Markel said, well, I'll start an insurance company to take that risk. Now, I don't know what the chicken and egg was, whether Sam had the chess moves all laid out before he proposed the ordinance. I would not be surprised if he did. But that was really the start and the genesis of the company. And they caught a mega wave in the sense that the automobile, trucks, the highway system, the interstate highway system, for 30 or 40 years, you really had this tailwind of epic growth in the underlying business that they would insure. We could go on and on with this conversation, but I think the hallmark that still matters today is you look at problems, you look at something that somebody needs, you try to be creative, you try to figure out a way to solve it, and that's what Markel does. Historically, largely through insurance products and insuring things that a lot of other companies choose not to do for a variety of legitimate reasons. But then also we've expanded into a lot of different products and services, industrial products and services over the last 15 years with the growth of Markel Ventures. So we can do anything and everything. And if we can figure out a way to make the customers and the employees better off by doing so, we'll do it.
So the interesting thing about the insurance side is insurers take in cash against a future potential liability. But between when the policy is sold and when a payout has to be made, hey, we have to do something with all this capital, which brings us to your job. You're essentially CIO of Markel Assets. How do we describe your title? And we'll get to the co-CEO thing in a bit, but technically, what is your job description?
Well, the CIO, in terms of chief investment officer, as opposed to chief information officer, that is exactly the job I had prior to becoming the co-CEO. And effectively, it is still a job that's embedded in my role. Now, again, if you're a business historian and you have a sophisticated listening base, if you think about insurance, first off, set it up. Your initial point is correct in that an insurance company collects premiums today, and they're going to make a payment for a claim sometime in the future. So embedded in every single insurance company is an investment operation.
Right.
And historically, it's not been unusual for insurance companies to make the vast majority, if not the totality of their earnings from what they make on the investments while they're holding that pool of money. That's the case.
Right. If you can run the insurance side as a break even and then just be free to do what you want with that capital over until those potential liabilities come home to roost, that's not a bad source of capital. It's very cheap.
Exactly. And a lot of minds have figured that out and known about that. There's some interesting sort of financial history episodes. If you go back to the 1960s or 70s, when conglomerates were sort of the hot money things of the day, many of those had an insurance company as the financial core of the business. You think Gulf and Western, Teledyne, things like that. Now, I think there's an interesting cultural circumstance that's at play there, in that if you look at insurance companies that are run by investment people, oftentimes that movie didn't end that well. Because, you know, investment people have a certain mindset, a certain culture, a certain way of doing things, a certain
embracing
lifestyle,
risk.
A certain lifestyle they'd like to lead. Insurance people are probably not wired that way.
Yes.
And most insurance companies are run by people who came up through the discipline of insurance. So they were claims people, they were actuaries, they were salespeople, whatever. But the realm of insurance is what they're wired to do and how they understand life. They may or may not understand capital allocation and investments quite so much. Similarly, and as such, since they don't understand it, I don't think they appreciate it and the discipline and what's required to be really top league in that requirement. Similarly, investment people, when they run an insurance-based organization and they came up through the realm of investments, I think sometimes there's a tendency not to appreciate the detail work and right. the daily discipline of what it takes to run a very good insurance operation. So if you look at organizations that have successfully been able to balance that tension and have both sides of the house not have one overwhelm the other side, that list is very, very short.
Yep. And we're going to talk. Let's talk a little bit about that list. And part of the reason you're implying is, hey, some groups are a little too safety first and too risk averse if they're overly weighted on the insurance side. Other groups are too aggressive and risk embracing. You need that balance, which leads us to the comparison that I have to ask. When did you start first hearing yourself described as the next Warren Buffett, a mini Warren Buffett? He used Geico as a giant source of inexpensive capital and obviously did okay with it, right? Did pretty well with it, better than pretty well. When did you first start hearing these noises? Because you've been with Markel now for 20-something years?
A little over 30 years.
30
joined
years,
in 1990.
Wow. Geez, yeah. 31 years. So how long was it before these silly comparisons began?
Well, I guess the first time I really heard it was when I said it to myself looking in the mirror. And frankly, that would have happened even before I joined Markel.
Really?
Because the way that started was...
That's hilarious.
The first time I became aware of Buffett and Berkshire was in 1984 with the seminal Carol Loomis article in Fortune. And right. I can remember I worked for a firm called Davenport & Company of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful firm. Still there today. Been in Richmond since 1863. So
not going anywhere.
The head of the department was a gentleman named Joe Antrim. And I read this article, and here's how naive and stupid I was. So it was 1984. I was 22 years old, and I went into Joe's office, and I said, "Hey, Joe, have you ever heard of this guy named Warren Buffett?" And Joe was sort of a crusty fella, and he says, "It's Buffett, you idiot," and threw me out. Well, I went to the cutting-edge technology of the day, which was the Standard & Poor's tear sheet.
Right.
And I looked at the Berkshire Hathaway page, and my training is as an accountant. I started out as a CPA with PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I looked at those numbers, and I could tell without resorting to four decimal point calculations, they were good.
Right.
So I became aware of Berkshire at that point.
When did you first become a Berkshire investor?
Not until 1990, which also points out how stupid one can be. Because when I first saw
it... So he was right when he said, "Get out of my office."
Yes, exactly. He was right. So as a kid, and the stupid things you do as a kid, and I'll defer to the notion that at age 22, you're still a kid.
Sure.
So I'll ask for grace in that sense. So I looked at it. I could tell the numbers were good. And I made the searing mistake. I think the stock was $375 or something like that.
Ooh, so expensive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I said, no stock could possibly be worth that much.
Right.
So I made the great mistake of omission and sat there and watched it go from that to, I remember the first share we bought was $5,750. And by the way, that's still a pretty good buy.
Right.
But there's immense lessons to be learned from that. So the per share value as opposed to the per share price.
Let's
do your math and do your homework about that. And by the way, getting back to Teledyne, which is one of those companies that was on the list of balancing out the insurance and the industrial sides of the business under the leadership of Henry Singleton, Fayez Serafim is a famous money manager who made a lot of his reputation and returns by being right about Teledyne in the early days.
Right.
And people used to ask Serafim, "What's the next Teledyne?" And his famous response was, "The next Teledyne is Teledyne."
Yeah.
So when you got something right and you're going to have
stay with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Dance with the girl you brang with and keep dancing. But so answering your question about how the Berkshire comparison started to take place. So in 1986, Markel went public. And luck of the draw, I was the analyst at Davenport who was assigned to cover it.
Ah, there you go.
So I started covering Markel from the day of the IPO. And what I observed was here was an insurance company that made an underwriting profit. And at that time, in an era of meaningfully higher rates, mm-hmm. you didn't really need to be disciplined about your insurance so much because you make so much from interest income that you could engage in cash flow underwriting. You just wanted to get cash in the door and we'll worry about the claims.
Well, a nominal basis, not necessarily
correct.
On real basis,
correct.
But still.
But this was an unusual discipline. Mm-hmm. To stick to the idea of making an underwriting profit, even amidst the ability to earn epic investment returns. So what I saw, and by this time I'm 25 or so from the IPO, is that here's an insurance-based organization which is going to make dedicated to making an underwriting profit. And Steve Markel, who was the vice chairman at the time, was open-minded and had already started making some equity investments with those pennies of underwriting profit out of each dollar. So they had a long-term mentality from day one. So I saw that instantly. It was a light bulb kind of realization, and I wanted to own some of that stock and be connected to the company. So from 86 through 90, 4 years, Steve Markel became a friend, a mm-hmm. client, a business associate, and he might tell the story differently. I might tell it differently depending on the point of view. But I sort of begged him for a job for 4 years because I just wanted to be part of that. In 1990, Markel did one of their famous double the size of the company deals,
mm-hmm.
where they bought another company that was as large as what they were. Steve had been managing investments by himself, thought he might like a wingman, and offered me the job at that time. Got the call at that particular.
And I assume you jumped right at it.
Exactly.
And let me just stay with Markel for a moment. They famously don't hold analyst days, they don't give earnings guidance or things like that. At least that was the reputation back then. Tell us a little bit about that. What was the thinking behind, if you're going to cover us, you figure it out?
Well, there's a lot of layers to that, but I think it makes sense. Think about it this way. If you really are, as I said, the first definition of Markel, the family office, which is a very popular term
mm-hmm.
these days, that was not a term so much in 1990 when I joined. If you really want shareholders who are going to be there for a long period of time and have a sense of ownership and have a sense of partnership and really wish to be multi-generational investors, well, I run a business and setting aside the investment side, but the Markel Ventures sides of things, in the businesses that we run, which are long-term established businesses, I don't think, and the people who run those businesses do not think about their customers in a quarterly time frame. We think about our customers as, once you're a customer of ours, in whatever business we have, we want to be doing a good enough job for you and delivering enough value and delighting you in such a way that you want to keep doing business with us. So cutting that into quarterly timeframes and setting expectations that are tied to that, that just seems like a bad idea and contradictory to how we would really run a business. So we didn't have to think up all these things ourselves. We got to observe the way Buffett did things, and we've been going to the Berkshire Annual Meeting since 1991, which had been the first year I joined. Because what I said to Steve at that point was, in terms of investors that we wanted to get at Markel, the people who are most likely to understand what we're doing are people who already own Berkshire. So rather than try to get them to come to Richmond and engage, I said, well, let's, if you own there. Berkshire, you're already qualified. So let's go there and start meeting people. So that very first year that we were there, just because I'd been in the investment business for a couple of years, there were six people that were willing to sit down and drink coffee and eat bagels with Steve Markel and I. And we didn't have a formal presentation or anything. We just talked and answered their questions. And that went on for maybe 2.5-3 hours or something like that.
Wow.
In that room, six people. Chuck Ockrey was one, who's a legendary investor. I don't know whether he's been on your podcast or not. Wonderful guy. And
make an introduction.
He would be a well worthy person to talk to, and he's a meaningful teacher to me over many years.
We love
years.
People like that.
I do indeed. Michael Lowenstein, whose father was Louis Lowenstein, the professor at Columbia Business School.
Okay, sure.
Exactly. And one of his cousins, I can't remember who, but one wonderful family and sort of the right kind of people. A guy named Peter Kamen from Boston. Jonathan Brandt at Ruane Cunniff, mm-hmm. who's one of the panelists that asks Buffett questions at the meeting, whose father was a roommate and buddy of Buffett and Bill Ruane. So we started off with just an absolutely wonderful set of people. And all Steve and I said at the end of that meeting was, you know, we'll be back again next year. And if you know anyone who would be interested, please let them know and we'll get together.
Let's have another one of these.
Sure. So we started doing that, and that became an annual tradition. And we did that year after year after year. What started with six people, by the time you got to the year before last, which was the last in-person meeting that Berkshire had, we had something on the order of 1,200 or 1,300 people at that meeting. And again, same format. We open it up. We say, thank you for being here. Great to see you. What questions can we answer for you? And there are more Markel shareholders in that room than typically come to our annual meeting. So it really is cultivating of the community that's out there. And this year, unfortunately, because the Berkshire meeting was virtual and mm-hmm. the crowd wasn't there, I said, well, we have the opportunity to try to create some center of gravity in Richmond, Virginia, because that convening, that worldwide convening of people who are searching for certain values and certain ways of running a business, the world is hungry for that. So let's give them a forum and a venue to do so. So we found a concert arena in Richmond, Virginia that had a roof but open air to try to mm-hmm. you know, meet people halfway. The pandemic circumstances were getting better. We had a meeting. My goal was to get 100 out-of-town professional investors to attend. We ended up with about 150 professional investors. And then between employees, associates, local people, we had 500 people at that meeting. And we tried to make it fun. We had food trucks. We had beer trucks. We had a band. And that may seem minor, but it speaks to the culture of trying to connect with people in ways that you just cannot do in any other way than be with them, and to cultivate this long-term sense of ownership where your time horizons are infinite, eternal, rather than cut into quarterly things. So it's just an entirely different way of approaching things and thinking about things. So it doesn't really comport or match up with the typical way that major finance is done. Not right or wrong, just different.
I like it. I love the idea of Burning Man for finance.
Exactly.
Instead of, oh, great, another boring hotel conference room. I mean, the one good takeaway from the pandemic is those sorts of financial, you know, just deadly meetings, they seem to be attenuating quite a bit.
And I think people are maximizing their multitasking skills when they're listening to something like that on a Zoom call. I don't have the patience or the endurance to do that without fidgeting and looking at something else too.
I'm with you on it. Let's talk a little bit about your background, which has some really interesting things about it. You've described yourself as knowing that you're just good and not great. Explain that. Who goes out and says, I'm not great. I'm good, and I'm aware of that.
Well, I was in a discussion last night with an absolutely fascinating person, absolutely high-end quality on every measure you could think about. And that excellence shown through. And the discussion took this twist and turn where the distinction between an optimizer and a satisfier came up.
Sure.
And I think... there is a tendency among type A people, extraordinarily high accomplishment people, high achievers, to really latch onto the idea of optimization.
Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes there can be a hidden, intangible, unquantifiable cost to focusing entirely on optimizations all the time. Einstein says that, you know, not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that counts... Einstein's smarter than me. Here's a perfect example of it. if I can remember it.
Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts.
There you go. My special guest, Barry Ritholtz. Thanks for the pickup and the
win. Was that Einstein?
There.
I thought that was some management consultant said that.
I'm going to go with Einstein on that, but I'll defer to
makes it sound better.
I'll defer to the fact-checking experts on that. But the point is there's an element of intuition, of the intangible sense of spirit and culture that I find extraordinarily difficult to matter, that sometimes you got to let people have some room to make some mistakes and look at outcomes that are not optimized. And what you get in design thinking and in systems approach, if you're dealing with the right kind of systems, there's a bit of an evolutionary process where mistakes that you make start drifting away and things that you did right start compounding and magnifying themselves. And as such, if you just leave a little slack in the system and you don't try to press it to the last red line of what's there, you allow time and space and muscle and rest and energy to create things that you couldn't have thought of beforehand and that happened somewhat through serendipity. So I think humility, and it's an epic challenge. I'm 59 years old now, and fortunately things have worked out well, and I have credibility because my record is pretty good. I have a lot of empathy and understanding of the challenge that would face a 26-year-old or a 25-year-old or me at 22 trying to get on the ladder and get the career and get the leeway and latitude that I enjoy right now. Because if you think about it, say you're 22 or 25 and you're trying to pitch somebody to manage money for them or being given discretion, typically, if you just say the kinds of things that I do, we're long term and we're going to be patient and we're going to look at this and sift and sort, you don't really stand out enough to get people to write you a check.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Especially at 26.
Exactly. So you're forced, almost bullied by the system to make hyperbolic statements and claim precision and claim efforts that are superhuman just to get people to give you the job and give you the money to manage. And I think markets are quantum systems. They defy understanding. And you can do a lot of work and you can keep trying to get to the next decimal point of understanding, but there's a certain irreducible quantity to human psyche and greed and fear and all those sort of things that really do matter in markets. And I just think it's helpful to be humble, to acknowledge that. Don't pretend you can know it. And by virtue of not pretending that you can know it, I think you're more open to ideas, people, different ways of thinking, that you can start out with the premise that this person I'm talking to is probably smarter than I am. They're demonstrably smarter than I am. So I think I should listen and learn something. And if you just go about your daily life that way, you do learn things and you do get exposed to things. And the people that were right, they start to occupy a greater and greater share of your mind share. Mm-hmm. And the people who are wrong kind of drift away into a smaller and smaller thing. So the math of compounding really accentuates the positive, and it makes the mistakes drift away into irrelevance over time.
I do like the idea of not being a maximalist optimizer, to give you a little breathing space to allow creativity and collaboration and other things to bubble up. I don't remember whose quote I'm about to steal, but the line is, jazz is the space between the notes. And it's that same, you need a little breathing room in order to allow some creativity to take place.
Exactly.
So let's talk about a horrible, terrible, ridiculous mistake you've made. or at least, everyone else who does this, it's a horrible mistake. Co-CEOs is usually a disaster. Somehow, you guys seem to have made that work.
Yeah, I think you're correct to point out that that's not the odds way to bet. And I think it gets back to some of the history and culture of Markel that makes it work, in the sense that, all right, you had Sam Markel, who was the original founder of the company. He ran it from its inception up until, I think, the mid-50s, late 50s, something like that. Sam had four sons who were two sets of twins. And when he unfortunately died, the business then was taken over by the four sons. And they ran it essentially by unanimous consent.
Ooh.
I believe they had lunch every day,
uh-huh.
If not almost every day. And for any kind of strategic or more than just little decision, there had to be unanimity among the four.
Wow.
And I think you can sort of picture how this unspools.
Everyone has veto power.
Exactly. And the company did not grow that much during their era that they ran it. But then what happened? But so you went from one CEO to effectively four, despite what the titles might have been. So then the second generation started to go the way of all flesh.
Right.
And the third generation comes along. And at this point, there are 12 cousins that are in existence, some of whom worked for Markel, some of whom did not. And the generational transfer succession issue started to become paramount and become important. A lot of sifting and sorting about that.
Mm-hmm.
The public offering in 1986 was one of the tools used to bring about some finality of that.
Sure.
But at the end of all of that sifting and sorting, three of the 12 cousins said, we're in. And in effect, they did a leverage buyout of the second generation, where they gave them a note with a coupon to provide income and sale process to the second generation, but gave them the stub equity underneath of it, so that as they built the value of the business, it attributed to the equity as opposed to the debt mm-hmm. that was there for the second generation. The IPO did two things. It paid off that debt. It gave the company a little bit of a capital base. And culturally, it said, you don't need to be a member of the Markel family to own equity interest. And I'm a perfect example of that. I'm not a Markel family member. I'm not married to Markel. I have no Markel blood in me. But I've been there 30-some years. I've been there since I was a kid. So I feel like a member of the Markel family. And I own some equity in the company from the IPO, from day one.
Wow.
And had always sort of been accumulating more stock as time goes by. So there's that element of how the transition has taken place. So the four went down to three, and really a triumvirate of Steve Markel, Tony Markel, and Alan Kirshner, who was a cousin-in-law, ran the business for decades. And as they started to move on, Alan retired from the board a year and a half, 2 years or so ago. Steve and Tony are still on the board, but not active in day-to-day management. That went to 3-2. So Richie and myself, and it's also connected to the evolution of the business itself, in that historically the insurance business was the largest single piece of the company. Investments are there, but it's just the investment operation that's embedded in an insurance company. So mm-hmm. while we emphasize investments more than most, every insurance company has an investment operation. So that wasn't weird. As Markel Ventures has grown to become a substantial part of the company, you have two very distinct pieces of the company. So in reality, the way it works between Richie and myself is that, and this is really the way it worked with Alan, Tony, and Steve as well, in the era of the triumvirate, everything on the income statement reported to Tony Markel. So what branches did we have? How many salespeople? What were the locations? All the sort of things that would, the managing the real estate, all of that, would Tony would be the ultimate authority and really the ultimate CEO of that. And I was in the room sometimes when Alan and Steve would disagree with him, but they would always say at the end of that meeting, if that is your decision, that is your area, so we support you. And they walk out of the room, the door is closed, and the team speaks with one voice.
That's right.
Similarly, Steve was in charge of the balance sheet of the organization. And anything, the loss reserve setting, the M&A activity, strategic stuff like that, Steve was the ultimate authority on that sort of stuff. And Alan joked he was the world's highest paid referee because he would adjudicate disputes between the two of them to make sure that's how it worked. So with Richie and I, it's a slightly different gearing. He's in charge of the insurance operations of the business. I'm in charge of the investments and the ventures operations. And our normal working relationship is if something meaningful or substantive comes up in one of our areas, the first person that I will talk to about an upcoming deal or a big capital allocation decision, I'll talk to Richie and make sure he and I get on the same page. We don't see the world eye to eye on everything, but we function and work it out. And similarly, on an insurance thing, he would come to me first and we work that out. So on major capital allocation decisions, it's very important that he and I manage to find agreement. Mm-hmm. And we have. On day-to-day matters, the tactical execution of the business itself, we both operate as sole CEOs in the realm of the business we run.
So you mentioned, so we have insurance, we have asset management, and you mentioned the third arm, Markel Ventures. That's kind of unusual for an insurance company. Let's talk a little bit about what brought this division about and what sort of things you look at. What do you focus on?
Sure. Well, again, the way it came about was being aware of the Berkshire example where you saw Buffett and Buffett would give a lot of credit to Henry Singleton and Teledyne and seeing that model and how that worked. We'd always bought equity securities, and there's a construct and a way we think about what we buy. And really, it's the same thing we hope Markel shareholders think about us when they buy Markel stock. So we look for profitable businesses with good returns on capital that don't use too much debt to do it. We look for management teams with equal measures of talent and integrity. We look for businesses that have reinvestment opportunities or great capital discipline, and we look for that at a reasonable price. That's the quick and dirty way of describing what we look for when we're buying a public security. Well, from my point of view, whether that's buying 100 shares of something, 1,000 shares of something, or the entire company, the thought process is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. So we'd seen the example from Berkshire and Teledyne of what it meant to go from passive minority shareholders to actually controlling shareholders in diverse businesses, and that's really the way it happened. Really, from the first minute that I went to Markel in 1990, I always had it in the back of my mind that this would be a future leg of growth and sustainability for the company. It wasn't until 2005 that the stars aligned in a particular deal because it happened to be in Richmond, Virginia, because I happened to personally know the CEO. We were not in the traditional investment banking channels, deal flow channels. It just happened to, through serendipitous circumstance, some of that time and space that we talked about, found a company called AMF Bakery Equipment, mm-hmm. which if you eat a McDonald's hamburger or hot dog, very good odds that those buns and rolls were baked on AMF Bakery Equipment. It's a leading company at what they do in that world. So happened to be headquartered in Richmond, Virginia, happened to know the CEO, happened to know it was for sale, I knew the seller, and we were able to do a deal. And doing that one deal raises a flag, and then all of a sudden my phone starts to ring. And, I didn't know you guys would do that. And how about this business? How about that business? And it really has cascaded from that.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
So Berkshire is kind of known for when Buffett and Munger find a company they like that meets similar qualifications, including very, very strong leadership, talent, management of the company, they basically put them into the Berkshire family and let them run the business, continue running the business so successfully. I'm assuming you bring a similar approach.
That is correct. And for instance, one of the ways to validate that and look at what people do, not what they say, the CEO of AMF Bakery, who we bought that business with in 2005, is still the CEO of that business
16
today.
Years later.
Correct.
Wow.
So of the 20 or so businesses that we have bought over the last 16, 17 years, probably 15 or 16 of them are still run by the CEO who was there the day we showed up. So we are very much hopeful that the management team, the leadership team that is in place will stay with us and become part of the Markel family and grow and flourish, because we'll take the worry about capital off the table for them. Mm-hmm. We'll take, and I'll tell this story about AMF, for example. So, you know, it was owned by a local set of business people in Richmond, and it was what I would call a club private equity deal. Mm-hmm. So it was not levered to the extent that many private equity circumstances would be, but it had some leverage attached to it. And the CEO of the business, when I showed up and Markel bought things, I said, you know, in the old days, Ken, when a machine broke, that was a really bad day for you, because you had an unhappy customer and you had an interest bill to pay at the same time. And that creates tension. I said, these days and forever going forward, I'm not rooting for machines to break, but I know in the real world they do. And on that day, instead of that being a bad day, I now want that to be a good day. I want you to show up. I want you to fix it. I want you to make it right. I want you to make your customer happy. And if you do that, and you do that repeatedly, dependably, and never waver from that, what will happen over the course of the next 3, 5, 7 years is your reputation for being that person will grow and grow and grow. And you'll get paid fairly for doing that. So by removing the financial constraint mm-hmm. of an interest bill and adding the dimension of that time horizon where, look, I'm not going to worry about this quarter because I know this is the right thing to do. So we're just going to do it. And then the accounts will tally up with the results of that. But I'm willing to bet that'll be good. And that is a business that in a no-growth industry, they've done a couple of tuck-in deals since that time. Mm-hmm. But they're 6 times the size that they were the day
That's
we
impressive.
Showed up. And they're every bit as profitable, if not more so. And I think the mentality with which the business is run has been helped by the Markel Capital umbrella. We really give somebody the room to do what they want to do anyway.
So bakery equipment is the first acquisition you do. What are the next couple of acquisitions? And what, because from what I've read, there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason. It just seems as long as it meets those four metrics that you described in terms of profitability and return on capital, talent, integrity, et cetera, you guys seem to be pretty open-minded as to the sort of acquisitions that make sense for you.
Well, that's exactly right. And those four things are indeed the selection criteria. Now, if I wanted to speak in an academic setting and I wanted to convince the consultants and the academics that I did indeed have some sort of rational strategy, I could frame it in such a way where I said, what we are looking for is large companies within small industries. Because mm-hmm. if you look at a market leader in a small industry, what you have is a situation where you are the go-to vendor, you are the go-to supplier. You have some advantages of incumbency. And unless you mistreat your customer or do something wrong or don't keep up, you are highly likely to get the next order. So if you look at all our businesses, it is often the case that these companies are actually pretty well known and very good and very dominant at the little niche they're in. And because it's a small industry, that is not as attractive to bigger companies that are going to come after it. And because it is so well established and so dependent upon by their customers, it's harder to start up a competitor in the garage. And I don't think, the young geniuses at the Stanford Business School are trying to figure out breakthrough disruptive ways to break bread. So these are not the sort of things that people are talking about or are interested, but we can build a fine business by collecting these wonderful things and growing.
Give us another one. Tell us another example of a business that the average person might not think of as a long-term profitable business, but you guys have managed to put into your balance sheet and have been very happy.
Sure. Well, I mean, the most recent company that we bought is a company called Buckner Cranes. And this is an interesting case study as well, and why we get these things. Fourth generation family. So if a family business has made it to the fourth generation,
they know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. And there's something that's just fundamentally right about a circumstance like this. This was an inbound call. Somebody called us and said, laid out the snippet thumbnail case of what this company was and what they do. And they had started out in a steel erection business, and they'd rented cranes. And the crane size kept growing, and it kept becoming more and more sophisticated over time.
Right.
So their kind of cranes lift things from 300 to 1,000 tons.
Jeez.
And in addition to the crane itself, and it's a German manufacturer that supplies Buckner with its cranes, and Buckner in turn leases them out to the companies that are erecting wind turbines or very large structures or new football stadiums, things of that nature. And you can't just show up like at the Hertz rental lot and rent one of these things. You have to know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, oftentimes Buckner will provide the crew or the technical expertise to
for
operate.
For a fee, obviously.
Right, right. So it's a real value add kind of business with a good you know, physical base there. But the family and the family values really mattered to the family as they were looking to sell their business and create liquidity for the third generation, but set the fourth generation up for mm-hmm. success to run the business going forward. So they called, we went down to visit them. Immediately we struck up a warm and friendly relationship and did a home and home and came to terms, and it came on board. So that's how some things like this happen. And at that 300 ton to 1,000 ton crane, I mean 1,000 ton lifts, you can't do that over the internet. You can't do that from a foreign country. There's certain underwriting criteria that if you right. really go through the traps of what you're looking at, that speaks to the likely durability and need for that business. If you need to lift something that's 1,000 tons, there are not many people in the world who know how to do that.
Right.
And again, I don't think that's the kind of thing that kids in business school are trying to figure out how to disrupt that. You can't. It's heavy. You got
to
lift it.
It's too small to be worth their time and effort, but it's large enough that there's a real business there.
Exactly. These stories could just go on and on and on. We're the largest grower of indoor houseplants in the world through our Costa Farms business. So if you go into
indoor houseplants.
Correct.
Huh. So when I go to the local whatever.
Home Depot, Lowe's, Walmart, yep. IKEA, Kroger, all those kinds of folks.
So your Markel is the company that's providing those.
Correct.
And
Costa Farms is the name of that company. And even within Costa, there will be sub-brands within that. So you don't exactly know when you're looking at the label who the ultimate folks are, but that would be us.
Very interesting. So there are two data points I'm kind of fascinated about. One is in your public investments, your 10 largest holdings, they're almost half your portfolio. They're about 45%. That's pretty unusual. When I look at the average, let's look at a stock mutual fund, the top 10 holdings usually way below 30%. Tell us why you approach this with such a concentrated bet on those top 10 stocks.
Well, I think there are a couple things that come together. And one of my great investment teachers was my grandmother. So let me get to her in just a minute. Now, obviously, those 10 have worked, and those have been circumstances where we're basically right, and I had a high degree of confidence in order to make some substantial bets to put them in the portfolio at that size. But then time and being right about your fundamental underwriting of the business kind of is your friend. As Charlie Munger says, you know, time is the friend of a wonderful business and the enemy of a mediocre business.
Mm-hmm.
So here's my grandmother's story. So when I was a kid and a nerd at that on Friday nights, unfortunately, instead of being able to get a date, sometimes I would sit with my grandmother and we would watch Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser. And my grandmother, she was widowed and my grandfather had died. And she was one of the types of widows that basically never made any substantive decisions after that. So she remained in the same house His suits hung from the rack in the closet. His shoes were on the floor. And being a just a small town local businessman in the 1960s, they would have been the type that, you know, they drank coffee at the diner together and they would talk about their stock portfolio and that sort of thing. That's what small town business people did. And he had a 12, 15 stock little portfolio. These are not massive sums of money. And those 12, 13, 14 stocks that my grandfather had when he died, my grandmother held those until she died. Now, within those that little portfolio, there was Lockheed Martin and Pepsi. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact of the matter is the other 10 holdings could have gone to zero. Right. And it wouldn't have mattered. The total. I mean, I'll bet my grandmother was in the 95th percentile in investment returns, basically because she caught two mega winners that she was able to hold for 30 years. And in terms of the growing dividends and funding her pleasant but modest lifestyle, it did that. And I observed that basically when you're right about something, don't get off the train if that train mm-hmm. is gonna keep rolling. I think we're both searching for who we should attribute these quotes to, but I think it might have been Peter Lynch talked about that human tendency to want to, you know, sell your winners.
Ring the
bell, exactly. Well, that's pulling the flowers and watering the weeds.
That's right. So, that is the Peter Lynch
exactly.
quote.
Exactly. So I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but I try not to be the dumbest. If I got a flower that's blooming, let it grow.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
And another data point that's kind of mind-blowing. So your capital portfolio is about $27 billion. Your costs are just incredibly low at less than 0.01, about 1/70th the cost of the typical U.S. stock mutual fund. How do you manage to keep your cost structure that low?
Well, we don't have a lot of people. So it's myself. I've had a gentleman named Dan Gertner who works for me on the equity side that's been there 10 or 12 years. For the first 17 years that I was at Markel after Steve hired me, we managed the portfolio in-house, and I did that solo. After 17 years of doing that, I decided to add one person, and that was Dan. And then a couple years ago, I added one more person. So we have that group of people thinking about the equity investment portfolio. We have three people working on the fixed income side, which is also a treasury function of managing just mm-hmm. the cash balances
right.
of the company. So we have an extraordinarily small number of people doing it. By Wall Street standards, our compensation is very modest, so that keeps the costs down. And here's the implicit cost savings that cannot even be measured or quantified, but make the numbers you cited even better, is our turnover is extraordinarily low. Mm-hmm. We tend to be able to buy things and hold them for a long period of time, which means we're not incurring the tax costs of realizing gains and paying the tax at that point. So the growth in the deferred tax liability, which is just compounding over time, that isn't an easily quantifiable cost, and it's not captured in that basis point of management figure you're talking about. But in terms of dollars, that's bigger than all the others by multiples.
Quite interesting. So we talked a little bit about Markel Ventures earlier. You're not doing what I think of as venture capital as early seed stage. You're buying mature companies. And you mentioned you've done 15 of these deals since 2000. We talked about the crane company. We talked about the bakery machinery company. Give us another example of the sort of transaction that attracts your attention.
Well, a couple of other examples. If we have a company called the Cottrell. And if you're driving up and down the highway and you see a trailer hauling 7, 8, or 9 cars, mm-hmm. we're the dominant company that makes those trailers.
Oh, really?
And we've owned that. I lose track of time. It's 5-8 years, something like that. Spectacular business. And the gentleman who runs it, Danny Zink, just a first-rate individual. They
open carriers is like when they pull up to a car dealership and 20 new cars roll off. It's one of those.
That's exactly right. Huh. So they've just done a spectacular job over many, many years of taking care of their customers and incrementally sort of getting more and more of the flow. And the wonderful thing about that particular business, and there are a variety of reasons that we were able to buy it, it's cyclical. So, for instance, when car sales are going up, and there is incremental demand for the trailers to move the cars around, it's a nicely profitable business, and they're going to earn good returns if they run their internal operations reasonably well. If car sales are flat or going down, they're going to struggle to break even, and there's nothing they can do about that. You can't reduce your prices by 10% to induce demand. People either need it right now or they don't need it at all. Now, that makes that business a little hard to finance if you're using a lot of debt to buy it. So by virtue of the fact that we're not using debt to do that, our underwriting decisions gets to be a lot easier. And you don't need to have an MBA to sort of figure this out. My math was, if I buy that today, I'm pretty sure that within the course of the next 5 years, I'm going to get out all my money and then still own the business, which is probably better and bigger in 5 years, especially with the culture they have and the people that are running it. And I really have some indifference about whether I make zero in year one and 40% of it in year two and 10% of it in year three and zero again in year four and whatever the residual is in year five. That pattern doesn't matter to me because I'm not trying to hit quarterly goals. And as such, we're able to be competitive to buy businesses like that because we're not competing with people who are using leverage finance to do so. So that's just another small example. And cars, I was about to make the mistake of saying cars can't drive themselves. But, you know, we'll get to
that. Well, arguably they still can, but they'll get there eventually.
That was one of the things we thought about. And even if you have a car that can drive itself,
You want a brand new car to come off the carrier.
Correct. You want it to have 12 miles on it, not 700.
So let me ask you a little bit of a twist question. How do you know if one of your acquisitions is not working out? I mean, there's some pretty clear metrics for, hey, we're seeing revenues increase, we're seeing profitabilities increase. How do you measure when, hey, maybe we made a mistake, this one isn't working out?
Sure. Well, Mike Heaton, who is my partner in Markel Ventures, and he's the president of Markel Ventures, so day-to-day execution of the Markel Ventures business, he has a great saying. He says, you know what it feels like when you're making a mistake? It feels great. Because if it didn't feel good, you wouldn't do it.
Exactly right. That's very funny.
So we make mistakes. We do that. But we do have financial reporting. And again, I started out life as an accountant. And the accounting profession, we could do hours and hours on the paths of the accounting profession. But a good accountant, a true accountant, an accountant who is honoring his craft, is giving you a feedback loop that this worked or didn't work. So when we make mistakes in the fullness of time, they show up. So what we do is we stop doing that. And we do more of the things that work and we do less of the things that didn't work. And over time, the weighted average of that really works in your favor. And again, I use that language very precisely, the weighted average, because the things that worked mathematically become larger and larger as a percentage of the total, whereas the things that didn't work become less and less a percentage of the total. So the mistakes get diluted into the overall solution, which in aggregate worked out just fine. It's my grandmother's lesson. I really don't know the names of those other 10 stocks she owned.
But it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Right. So you pride yourself on investing with management groups that not only have been successful, but have integrity and have built a corporate culture of both quality and success. Raises an interesting question. During COVID, you have 20,000 employees. How did you maintain that corporate culture? How did you keep everybody involved, integrated, and all moving in the same direction?
Well, I wrote in last year's annual report, there's been an unprecedented use of the word unprecedented.
Yeah.
And that's an accurate statement to make. None of us had a playbook for how to do this and how to proceed. And of those 20,000 people, 15,000 of them are within ventures, and a lot of them are in the category of frontline workers, one of our businesses called Havco, and it makes the flooring for trailers of tractor trailers, and it's wood. And as the president of that business, a guy named Bruce Bader, said, you can't make wood floors from home.
So that's right.
We had to keep a factory running, and we had to figure out how to operate cleaning procedures, sanitation procedures, not wildly unlike the procedures that existed to get into this building this morning. You got to figure all of that out on the fly, and we did so. And I am so amazed and so grateful for the ways in which the leaders of those companies, and by that I mean not just the CEOs, but the people who work for them and the frontline supervisors and all of the associates who they went to work, among other reasons, because they needed to work.
Right.
And so it's our job to figure out, look, if you want to work and you can work, and by the way, our society needs you, we must find a way to figure out how to do that as safely and as effectively and as efficiently as possible. That's our job. So that's really what we have been about. And the very act of doing that, it's almost like exercising. So if you want to lift a lot of weight, I would suggest, and that weight is just too much for you right now, but it's within the realm of theoretical possibility, I would suggest to you, well, let's lift a little bit. Let's lift 25% of that. Now, let's do it a couple times. And then when we can do that and do it a couple times, well, let's lift 35% of that. You build muscle by doing. These are not theoretical exercises. So there are some theories that guide you. But the very act of doing itself is what creates the learning of how to do it. So there's been a lot of that going on where we've been learning how to move differently and lift different weights of what we had. And in and of itself, that act has reinforced culture where you could choose. And I believe there is a great choosing going on, not just at Markel, but really sort of society writ large, of whether you really want to do that or not. And there are some professions and some circumstances where you don't have to quite do that so much. In our business, you do. Both in the 15,000 frontline workers, and I would argue in a second derivative sense, even the white-collar workforce that can work remotely, there's something about being together in person, the water cooler conversations, the coffee cup conversations, the quips, the use of humor, and laughing and joking and going back and forth that's really hard to do in a virtual world that I think there is a place for everything in this world. It's not right or wrong. It is just different. So we run the gamut of where it's just the physical reality, whether we're making wood floors or lifting 1,000 tons, you got to be present to win. So you got to do that in person. And that creates some aspects of the culture by itself of doing so. There's some that's creative. So you may not think of us as a creative business, an insurance operation or white collar work, but it's almost like an advertising agency. So there are some parts of our business which are actuarial and formula and mathematically driven, but there's a lot of our insurance business which is more like an advertising agency than it is a big insurance company, because you got to be creative and you got to figure out how to solve this problem of some risk that's not going to be priced.
You took the words out of my mouth. Yeah. All problem solving, unless you're doing basic arithmetic, involves creativity. Hey, maybe this will work. Sometimes not every solution is ideal for this problem. Let's see what else we can come up with. And that doesn't really work great over a Zoom. Let's talk a little bit about some of your favorite companies. You have some holdings. And when I look at some of your top five or top 10, they're almost nothing like each other. There's just a mix of companies: CarMax, Disney, Berkshire, Amazon, Regeneron, and then a whole bunch of investing firms: BlackRock, Federated, Oaktree, T. Rowe. Have I named anything that you've jettisoned since? Or
actually, you know, Oaktree is no longer with us. That's part of Brookfield Asset Management, which is our second largest holding that we have, and we are no longer owners of CarMax.
Oh, you sold CarMax, which had a huge run up.
Correct.
Given the craziness with supply chain and. I think at a certain point that just became fully valued.
I would admit an error on my part in this. And in fact, the gentleman who runs CarMax, the CEO, I mean, we'd owned it for a long time. It had been an absolutely great holding. When we sold it, I called him and I said, Bill, that was our circumstance, not yours. CarMax is a great company. It's very well run. I have epic respect for what they do. We enjoyed being a shareholder for a long, long time. When we go back to the initial days of the pandemic and the shock losses from event cancellation, insurance, business interruption, which was uncertain, in the first quarter of 2020, I lose track of years and time these days, we reported a combined ratio of 118. So as compared to our historical record of underwriting profitability, where that combined ratio number would always be below 100, 118, that is the worst period Markel Corporation has endured in 90 years of existence.
Wasn't a great quarter.
It was not a great quarter. And the model where we're using the profits from the insurance company to create the flow, to create the funds.
Now you're reversing that.
Exactly. So jet engines don't fly in reverse.
Right.
That jet engine was flying in reverse during the first quarter of 2020. As such, and I think even independent of that, there were kind of a combined set of forces at work where, look, we got to make sure that the insurance business is on firm capital footings. It's a regulated business.
Sure.
And we always want margin of safety, margin of error, that humility. Look, let's not pretend we're the smartest. So if we were the dumbest, what do we need to do to protect ourselves from us?
Right.
To make sure we keep going. So we would have re-underwritten, and here's what we did. We re-underwrote every single security we wrote. And by the way, in that environment, we also re-underwrote our thinking on every insurance policy we wrote, because it was clear that this was a fundamental change that had overtaken all of us. So let's make sure that we're adaptable and think, and that we're able to answer the bell for the next round of the fight. So in looking at each and every security that we owned and recognizing, look, I want to take a little money on the off the table, and I wish to make sure that the capital footings are impeccably sound and unquestionable, looking at each and every one, among the decisions that we decided to sell was CarMax. And I thought, you know, at that point in time, 50% of the locations were closed. Who needs a new car? Who needs a used car? Well, it turns out everybody did.
Right.
But I did not foresee that coming. And just given the time and facts of the circumstances, there were several things we sold at that point. In retrospect, they all went up, and they all went up a lot since that sale. But at the same time, our capital basis has never been questioned. The integrity of the business is there. And we kept 80% of what we owned at that point across the board in aggregate. And that's done great. So, you know, we're in.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Good shape.
You would have had to anticipate not only a surge of movement to the suburbs that would require more cars, but you would have had to anticipate all of the supply chain on the semiconductor, all that whole interruption and supply issues that have led to just a surge in used car prices and unavailability of new cars. Kind of hard to foresee coming. In the first quarter of 2020.
As I wrote in last year's annual report on the whole discussion of the pandemic stuff, we did not see that coming. So it's a long list of stuff we did not see coming. So add those to the list as well.
So let's talk about some of the companies you kept, because not a bunch of stiffs. There's some pretty good companies. I want to get a sense of the thought process as to what leads you to find a company. I guess in some ways Disney and Amazon are somewhat similar, but in so many ways they're so different. What led you to each of them, and what led you to stay with them over the long haul?
Well, let me take each of those two, because I think they
instructive.
They are instructive. So take Amazon as an example. I talked earlier about the importance of the shareholders of Markel and the desire that we have at Markel to have great shareholders who are thoughtful and intelligent and really contribute ideas and thoughts to me and to Markel that make us better. And specifically with Amazon, I have a friend named Josh Tarasoff, who runs his own investment management firm, and he's done extraordinarily well. He's a Markel shareholder, a friend. And so we had a relationship. We talked back and forth. And Josh noticed that if you went back, and I can't, again, I lose track of time, a decade or more, whatever, our holdings in the world of technology were pretty slim. Call it, let's round it to zero, not much. and Josh, in his kind and helpful and gentle way, was helping me realize I might be making a mistake about this.
And when you say kind and gentle, was he like, Tom, what the hell are you doing here? You missing the boat? Or was he, you know, how kind and how gentle?
He really was kind and gentle.
Okay.
So despite, I mean, I love New Yorkers because they are.
By the way, that was kind and gentle, just
exactly.
So you know.
Exactly. No, I understand that completely. And there's no mystery or subterfuge about that. You're
right.
Saying, look, what is wrong with you? I get that. So I can absorb that and not take it personally. But by the way, Josh is a kind and gentle person, but he really walked me through thinking about Amazon and helping me to come to understanding in a much more productive way than I had in the past. So that's point number one.
So that trade worked out, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's more green than red on that one. And here's the other thing that really matters. So one of my hiccups or concerns about Amazon would have been the idea of the valuation at that instant. You know, what is it if I pencil out numbers? And because Markel has been a profitable insurance underwriting organization for so long, what that creates is regular periodic cash flow and the ability to do dollar cost averaging.
Uh-huh.
So I've been at Markel a little over 30 years. Well, times four for a quarter, that's 120 quarters. And I would say of those 120 quarters that I've been there, the insurance operations and now the ventures operations as well have deposited cash into the investment account, maybe 116 out of those 120 quarters.
So you have money to put to work
exactly,
every quarter.
Exactly. And if I make a mistake, among the mistakes you can make are you can make a mistake about valuation
mm-hmm.
where, look, this is a great company, but it's just really high priced. And so you paid too much for it. Or you can make a mistake about the business itself. It's not as good a business as you thought it was. Well, if I'm right about the second thing, that this is really a good business, I get to solve for the valuation problem a little bit by dollar cost averaging,
right,
just nibble over time. And again, the ultimate return that you earn if you really have a long-term horizon is the intrinsic return that the business itself earns, not the trading returns from the more volatile stock
mm-hmm.
price. It's the underlying returns on capital that the business itself earns. So dollar cost averaging and flow and time, it enables you to get to the point where you can power your way through a valuation error,
especially if the growth is that strong.
Exactly. I mean, that needs to be true for you to be able to power through the valuation problem. If the growth doesn't happen, then you've got a problem on your hands.
What about a company like Regeneron, which seems to be so industry specific?
Yeah, and I'm going to give credit to my colleague Dan Gertner for that mm-hmm. particular stock. That is his pick. And the way our system works, he has a sleeve of money that he manages. He gets a portion of that flow as well. And part of his job for me is to signal through his purchases what he has conviction about. And Regeneron is his idea and something that he has conviction about. And again, if you look at Regeneron's performance over the last 5-10 years, I mean,
especially the past 2 years have been pretty good.
But even more than that, and again, while Dan is the expert on that, not me, you have founder leaders who are in place. You have a culture of scientific discovery that seems to be embedded in that organization. And talk about sort of the comfort level that you get from investing in people that are making the world a better place rather than a worse place. Regeneron's solving some thorny problems, and I, as a human being, am grateful for what they do and what they've come up with. So I'm sort of rooting for them. So it wins on a lot of different counts.
So I saw you give a speech some years ago where you said, hey, when you walk into the bar, you want to be the bartender, not the people at paying for drinks. And hence the parallel or things like BlackRock and T. Rowe Price. Tell us about the thoughts about investing in the world of financial services.
Yes, I think it's fundamentally, historically been a very good business for a long time. I think that'll continue to be the case. So
now a lot of people look at this space, I'm sorry to interrupt, but a lot of people look at the space and say, hey, there's fee pressure and there's competition from crypto and from private equity and from all this other stuff. How do you respond to that?
I think there's always been competition. Competition is just the nature of things. That's all. To bring in a different topic, the idea of theology. They said Martin Luther's great gift to the world was not the theology of Lutheranism. It was competition. So the Catholic Church had some competition. It's been going on for a long time. It is the nature of creativity and freedom that and this is a wonderful thing that you hope somebody somewhere is saying, you know, I could do that better than that. Our world progresses on account of that. Uh-huh. But and here's the other advantage in financial services. There's not a lot of sunk costs when you have a financial operation. So if something is not profitable, you don't have a plan that you need to
suggest. Right.
Exactly.
So fire that group and move on.
Correct.
Right? It's all human capital.
Keep
it's
going.
It's not big factories or cranes or any of that
right.
stuff.
Right.
It's your people are your assets.
Right.
And, you know, you're constantly, they're all competing with one another to show their ability to
right.
produce.
So if you look at sort of anything in the financial services businesses, by and large, it's like our, you know, body temperature that we have to check before we come into the building today.
Right.
98.6. And look, if you're 101.6, I'm betting they wouldn't have let me in here today.
For sure.
Pretty quick feedback loops.
Yes.
So financial services groups, and this is a really important notion, the idea of feedback loops and awareness and tying that to humility and just always being willing to listen to other people. Where people get themselves in trouble is where they don't pay attention to feedback loops. And there are some things that I put in the category, these are mistakes that only experts can make. Because people are so sure of themselves. And I read a wonderful book recently called The Long Gray Line. And it's by a gentleman named Rick Atkinson. It is about the West Point class of 1966.
Uh-huh.
This is a really good book. And if you think about that, just picture it in your mind for a second. So those kids, and they were kids when they started, would have been entering West Point at 1962. The height of idealism and JFK and moon race and all that sort of stuff. And the author does this great job of connecting you to this kid from Wisconsin, and this kid from Tennessee, and this kid from upstate New York, and their girlfriends and their family and their situations. And you really felt like you got to know them. And then you got to follow them through their 4 years at West Point and who was the rule follower and who was the rule breaker and the branches of the army that they decided to go to, so on and so forth. And then they finish in 1966. And they get dumped into Vietnam.
Right.
And you hear their stories and the tragic circumstance of what was involved. And if the people who were in charge had listened to the people who were on the ground, we would have done things differently. And when you see that so vividly explained there, it puts me in the situation where we have 20-some thousand people working for Markel. I feel responsible for them, and I feel responsible for the decisions that I make that affect them with no control or ability to influence their fate by themselves sometime. So I always want to personally guard against being that expert who thinks he knows. I want to listen. I want to hear it. I want to get that sense of what the people with boots on the ground who were there doing it have. And that feedback loop of just staying connected to that is a fundamentally important philosophy and way of doing things.
Huh. I like that a whole lot. Last company I want to ask you before we get to our favorite questions. You have been a Marriott shareholder for a long time. Are you still a shareholder?
Unfortunately, no. And again, that was also
in
a
the
decision
first quarter
that was
of the pandemic.
Exactly.
I mean, they still haven't recovered.
Yeah, and my goodness, if you, I mean, Arne Sorensen, who did a spectacular job as the leader there, if you saw the video that he put out mm-hmm. in the early days of the pandemic and the emotions that were there. And
I'm sure,
I don't know whether the cancer had been disclosed at that point
right.
or not. That was a first class individual doing first class things. I still have every epic regard for the business, but given their circumstances and our circumstances, I needed to make the painful but difficult decision to eliminate that from the portfolio. And tactically you could say, and I'll admit, made a mistake. That stock price is higher today than it was when we sold it but we sold it for different reasons than just what the stock price was at that point.
Quite fascinating. Tom, I know I only have you for a couple of minutes, and I have to thank you for being so generous with your time, but let's jump to all of our favorite questions we ask all of our guests, see if we can get a little insight into, a little more insight into who you are and what makes you tick, starting with, tell us what has kept you entertained during the past 18 months. What are you watching on either Netflix or Amazon Prime during this period when we've all been stuck at home?
Well, sure. I am completely grateful for the return of live sports and live music, because those are both things that I just love immensely. And it's football season, and I'm more of a college football guy, but to be able to go back to UVA and be in person for those games, and over the last 40 years, I bet I've missed no more than 5 home football games at UVA. And it's what my family does. So I went to UVA. My wife went to UVA. I have 3 children who went to UVA.
Do you dress everybody up in the garb and you hit the stadium?
Fortunately, my children are old enough that I don't have to dress them anymore. And when they were young enough to have to be dressed, pretty much my wife did that. So I'm not much of a
But I mean, you're wearing all UVA swag when you show up.
We're there. We're good for that. So it's fun to be back at live sporting events and live music. In terms of podcasts and streaming, I'll tell you one that has really captured me is Broken Record with Rick Rubin. I don't know if you know Rick Rubin,
sure,
music producer.
Yeah, absolutely.
With complete diversified portfolio, everybody from Jay-Z to Johnny Cash.
Did he record a Springsteen album, if memory serves correctly?
I don't know, but I certainly wouldn't rule it out. Who didn't he record and who didn't he do over the last 30 years? So it's a fabulous way of learning history when you have somebody as knowledgeable as what Rick Rubin is and has been connected to so much music. I mean, music reflects the zeitgeist of the times, and whether it's reflecting it or causing it, it's right there. So for these artists to talk about their craft and talk about their art with Rick, I find those conversations to be things that I really learn from and have been just sort of, as I go out and walk, listening to that podcast quite a bit. It's my favorite one.
I'm going to check that out. I'm a big music fan. Since you mentioned going to live shows, what live acts have you seen since the world has begun to reopen?
Well, there's a particular artist in Virginia. I'll give him a plug here. His name is Scott Miller. He's from Swope, Virginia, which is outside Stanton. And neither one of them sounds the way it's spelled. And I'll let your viewers Google that map and figure out what I'm saying there. But Scott, I would describe as someone who has sort of a definitive Virginia voice. So listen to his music. It's singer-songwriter folk stuff. And I think I've heard him about 4 or 5 times since the pandemic has ended. First, when first live shows started, he had one in Stanton, Virginia, and then one up in Natural Chimneys, which is near Harrisonburg, Virginia. So he'd done 2 shows in 2 weeks. And I had been to both shows, so I was telling people I had been to 100% of the Scott Miller concerts that had been since the pandemic. And I'm not still at 100%, but anytime I get the chance to hear him, I look to do so. One of the artists that during the pandemic said he's not touring anymore is Aaron Neville. Mm-hmm. He's probably a little more well-known than Scott Miller. Up until the pandemic, that's the artist who I'd seen the most times and absolutely love his music, and just being in a room where Aaron Neville is singing, that's a good thing.
Yeah, to say the least. The Neville brothers also, the whole family, super talented.
Correct.
Let's talk about your early mentors. Who helped shape or guide your career?
Well, clearly my father probably occupies a singular spot in that. He was a CPA in Salem County, New Jersey. And Salem County, compared to most parts of New Jersey, is very rural. He would have started his CPA practice in Salem County probably in the early 1950s after serving in World War II and finishing up his education at Temple on the GI Bill, just to give you some insight into my father and the way he did things. So he became a reasonably successful businessman over time. And when people would ask him where he went to school, he would say, Temple O. And I observed my father doing that all the time. And I kind of one time asked him, Dad, when people ask you where you go to school, you say Temple. Oh, why do you do that? He said, well, when I say Temple, people say, oh. So I figured I'd save them the time.
That's very funny.
But that's an insight into the way he did things. And I don't know if you remember the show Green Acres.
Sure.
Well, there was Mr. Douglas and Mr. Haney as the polar opposites, and my father was somewhere between the two. Hmm. So he had practiced with a predecessor firm of Deloitte in Philadelphia, but left the big city to return to where he was born in Salem County and became an accountant there. And he had a very interesting practice. So he would do people's tax work. He did business consulting. He owned a liquor store, among other things. He would put together deals, and as opposed to taking a fee, would take a percentage interest in the business, mm-hmm. so a little bit of carried interest. And his office was in our home. And in the house where I grew up, among other things, in addition to just adoring my father and liking him and hanging out with him, in the farmhouse we grew up in, there were only two rooms that were air-conditioned. One was my parents' bedroom, and the other was his office. So for all kinds of reasons, I hung out at his office, and he read the Wall Street Journal, so I read the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal. And as a kid, doing my homework or just sitting in his office coloring books or reading whatever, I would hear him as he was talking to people on the phone, or people would be in and out, and he was kind enough. I came along a little bit later in his life where I was just allowed to be an observer and through osmosis pick up the idea of business without formal instruction, but that was the case from an early age. Hmm. So many of the things I learned about life and business was just hanging around with my dad through the early years of my life.
Hmm. Interesting. You mentioned The Long Gray Line. What are some of your other favorite books? What have you been reading lately, and what are some of your favorites?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, and I read all the time. That's what I do in spare moments, and I love traveling for so many reasons, not the least of which is I always have a book in my hand and a bag of stuff to read, and it's like asking me, what did I eat last Tuesday? I don't know, but I'm sure I ate something. So I always draw a blank when people ask me that question. I know what I'm reading right now.
Tell us what you're reading.
It's The Lincoln Highway by Amor Towles. Mm-hmm. And I thought his book, Gentleman in Moscow, was a spectacular book. So I eagerly awaited his next book that has come out recently. I think it might be even better written than Gentleman in Moscow. So it's a wonderful book. And I will say one thing about reading. I mean, obviously, connects to role models. Charlie Munger is about as good as they get, right, at the top of the list. Munger talks about not reading fiction, and he thinks it's a waste of time. That's something that I would disagree with. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons I enjoy fiction is fiction, by definition, creates muscles of empathy. To read a good work of fiction, what's going to happen is you're going to find yourself sort of inhabiting the character. And you're going to find yourself in that setting and in that circumstance. And what you're doing without even realizing is you're figuring out and learning how to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And I think that is a very underappreciated skill in today's world, where it's so easy to just get inside your own head and live in your own world, to live and work remotely, to have your groceries delivered.
Sure.
You kind of forget what it means to be part of a broader society. And to be able to see things from somebody else's point of view, I can't think of anything that's really more powerful than that. So I think the tool of reading fiction, just to teach yourself how to do that, is a really good way of doing things.
I'm going to share something amusing with you. We were having a conversation about Isaac Asimov's Foundation is now a show on Apple Plus, and Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune, not only is it in theaters, but it's on HBO Max. And the conversation we had amongst a group of investors are the kids like me who were big sci-fi nerds, not coincidentally, tend to be more inclined to invest in technology and some out there concepts than the people who always thought sci-fi was wacky. And I would be fascinated to find out if anybody has ever done a study on that. Because if it makes sense, hey, half the stuff we read about in sci-fi, self-driving cars, robots, magic shots of your own DNA that make diseases go away, that's 40, 60, 80 years old. And here it is, portable computers that allow you to do video talking in your pocket.
Right.
All this stuff is straight out of sci-fi. So who better to be investors in that than the people who it was formative for them as a child?
I can remember as a kid, I spent a lot of Saturdays in my youth at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, which mm-hmm. is their science museum. And I can remember the first telephone that had video attached to it.
Right.
And you would stand in one room and your friend would stand in the other room and you would talk to yourself over this amazing thing. And of course, it died because network effect at that time, it was so expensive
right.
that all right, you got one. Well, who are you going to call?
There's
nobody else who has
That's
one.
Right.
But it has become pervasive, and point is
absolutely.
Your point is well taken.
What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad who is interested in a career in either venture private equity investing or traditional finance investing?
Well, there's a guy named, here's a book I read, Robert Hagstrom, who has written a lot of books about Buffett. I think he wrote a book, if I'm remembering the title exactly right, called Investing, the Last Liberal Art. And it really is the concept and the notion of using both the right and left side of your brains, both of them, to analyze and be disciplined and do your work, but at the same time, never lose your sense of imagination, creativity, curiosity, wonder about what else might be true, what's the other side of the argument. I have one friend, Shad Rowe from Texas, who has Texas ways of saying things, and one of his statements that I always remember is that you must remember that any pancake, no matter how thin, has two sides.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the number one thing as you're coming up is just always be developing your mind, be developing your creativity, and be developing those feedback loops, and don't ever think you've arrived at the answer. This is not a problem to be solved. It's a problem to be worked at. And it's fun to work at. It's exercising your mind. It's freeing. It's like that scene from Chariots of Fire, where the sister is telling the runner, he shouldn't run on Sundays. And it was a person of deep faith. And he responded to his sister that, well, yes, the Lord gave me faith, but he also made me fast. So the run is how he feels his grace. That was what he was made to do. So I think if you are fascinated by finance and investments, and I know as a kid I always have been, doing it every day, reading something, talking to somebody, arguing a case back and forth, both sides. In fact, one of the things that I joke with Steve Markell about, he had this sort of rabbinical style about him where at any given point in time, his office was next to mine for many years. And if I had an idea, I would go into his office and I would tell Steve this idea. And he would say, that's just the dumbest thing I ever heard. And we would argue it. And I would go away and then I would come back a couple days later or something. And I said, Steve, I think actually you were right about that. And he would say, no, I think you were right about that. And then we would argue it the other way. And that was just the technique to get more robust understanding of what might in fact be the case. And usually it's not the polar extreme in either case. The answer is to be found somewhere in the middle. And as one of my digitally cool friends says, people have forgotten the fact that there are some numbers that exist between 0 and 100.
Right. The genius of law school is that moot court forces you to not pick a side and argue it. You have to be prepared not only to argue both sides, but at a moment's notice, switch positions, and suddenly you're no longer the plaintiff. You're now the defendant, and you have to make that case. And there's something to be said for you shouldn't be long anything unless you understand, you shouldn't be bullish on anything unless you understand the bear case,
right,
and vice versa.
Right.
Because, listen, someone's, for every buyer, there's a seller. There's two sides to, that pancake. You have to be able to be on, to see at least both sides of that argument.
Right.
So our final question, what do you know about the world of investing today you wish you knew 37 years ago or so when you were first getting started?
If I look at the mistakes that I've made, the ones that have been most costly have been those of omission.
Mm-hmm.
So to look at Berkshire when I was 22 years old and have it so obvious to me as an accountant that this is good and yet not buy it, that's stupid. And I think I make that mistake less than I used to. When you find something that's really good, here's another thing that Buffett said that has profoundly changed for me over time. He says, being an investor made him a better businessman, and being a businessman made him a better investor. I can tell you through the responsibility of what's involved in Markell Ventures and operating real businesses, I know from firsthand experience that operating a real business and doing well at it is hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. And people who are good at it, don't be so quick to abandon them when they go through a rough spot. Again, going back to Shad Rowe, he has a saying, he says, in the investment business, you're never, smart people, generally speaking, don't become stupid. And stupid people almost never become smart. So if you find smart, hardworking, intelligent, creative, dedicated people, stick with them because they're going to accomplish things over time that will amaze you, and give them the leeway, give them the grace to make mistakes when they are mistakes of learning and non-fatal that you can recover and learn from. And just having grace for that is something that's easier when you're older than it is when you're younger. So those are things I wish I knew as a 29-year-old instead of having to be 59 to know them.
That's a lovely point to end on. Thank you so much, Tom, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Tom Gaynor. He is the CIO and co-CEO of Markel Corporation. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of the previous 400 such discussions we've had. You can find those on Apple iTunes, iHeart Radio app, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. You can sign up for my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Paris Wald is my producer. Mohammed is my audio engineer. Michael Batnick is my head of research. Atika Valbron is our project manager. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.